On Capitol Hill, budget negotiators reached a tentative deal on border security funding last night that they hope will avert another government shutdown. But its provisions fall far short of the $5.7 billion for a U.S.-Mexico border wall. And a Friday midnight deadline looms. We're getting an update here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. What are you hoping for as you watch these budget negotiations? We're at 800-642-1234. Susan Johnson is a professor of political science at UW-Whitewater. She's also director of the Center for Political Science and Public Policy Research. Susan, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So we hear that congressional lawmakers, they met yesterday to discuss border funding solutions. There was some movement. What do we know about this agreement in principle?
Yeah, it's been quite a roller coaster over the weekend. I think leading into the weekend, we thought that there was a deal close at hand. And then this weekend, we heard that maybe there wasn't. And then late last evening, there was an agreement in principle, as you said. And what it would do is provide about $1.375 billion for 55 new miles of border fencing, and it's very clearly written into this agreement that that cannot be a concrete wall, but they can use other means to provide some fencing. And, I mean, that's the main part of it, and then there would be an additional $1.7 billion or so for additional security and technology upgrades and also humanitarian aid for migrants who are arriving at the border. And as you mentioned, it falls far short of what President Trump had been demanding earlier on, which was $5.7 billion.
Yeah, and 1.375 is nowhere near that $5.7 billion mark. And there seems to be a lot of give and take here over the issue of immigration. Democrats had wanted to impose a cap on detention of immigrants apprehended with the U.S. That seems to have dropped out of this pending deal. In exchange, Republicans agreed to reduce the number of beds in detention centers. What are you seeing on this back and forth over immigration numbers?
Yeah, and so just as you said, there was this contentious issue that arose over the weekend about caps on immigrants and beds. And, I mean, the idea being that if you cap the number of beds, it makes it more difficult to detain people. So what was agreed upon in principle here is that this deal would set an average daily cap at about 45,000 beds, which is less than the number of people who are currently detained on average. And the Democrats are hoping that that number should continue to drop. On the other hand, this would still allow the president to have some authority to move money around in different accounts, and so the number of beds could go up.
Should we read into anything here that President Trump and Democratic leaders Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi were not at the meeting yesterday?
Well, I mean, I think what we saw happen was that, and this is often the case, that the congressional leadership, so people like Speaker Pelosi and the Democratic leaders in the Senate and then the Republican leaders in both the House and the Senate, would set a negotiating team in place and let those people get together and work out some of the details. And the people who were put in charge were chairs of relevant committees. And this is quite common for, I would say this is, you know, pretty normal operating procedure for Congress, which is what we're not quite used to lately. But those people got together, and they're veterans of congressional negotiations, and they came up with a deal. And there was, you know, as you kind of alluded to, there wasn't the acrimony that we saw when we had more of that staged negotiation, I would call it, between the Democratic top leadership, you know, even Republican top leadership, and the president.
Well, if lawmakers seem to be making some progress here, what we've seen in the past, though, that progress has then gone to the executive office, the president's office, and there's been a complete change of plans. Is there any inkling that might happen again?
There's always an inkling that potentially could happen again. President Trump can be quite unpredictable. The negotiators were asked whether or not the White House was on board, and they hedged a bit. They did indicate that the White House had been briefed fully. Last night, the president was having a rally in El Paso right around the same time that this deal was announced, and he, during his rally, he mentioned he heard about the deal, but he didn't know the details of the deal, and then he said something quite curious: we're going to build the wall anyway, which suggested that he knew that he wasn't getting his $5.7 billion in this particular negotiation. And then a lot of people in the right-wing media, Sean Hannity most notably, came out last night and said that the deal was garbage and that any Republican who supported it would be, I don't know what his exact words were, but would be sort of abandoning the principles of what we need for border security. So I'm really curious to see what President Trump is going to do. Under other circumstances, I would say this is a done deal. Once members of Congress come together, there's usually the tacit understanding that the president is on board as well, but I don't know in this instance.
We're talking with Susan Johnson. She is a political science professor at UW-Whitewater, director of the Center for Political Science and Public Policy Research. We're looking at budget negotiations last night, saying that there may be a tentative deal on border security funding that would avert another government shutdown that would be set to begin Saturday. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on this deal. Susan, President Trump has tweeted that Border Committee Democrats are behaving irrationally. They don't even want to make, quote, murderers or criminals into custody. Do you get the sense that Republicans aren't going to budge when they look at immigration, or that the president has a different focus when it comes to immigration?
Well, I mean, I think that you've got different groups of Republicans, and you have those that there's quite a few Republicans who are supportive of even, you know, deals to extend DACA and allow a path to citizenship and things like that. And this has been something that I would say members of Congress have worked on bipartisan, in a bipartisan way, for many years. They've not been able to pass anything, but you have a president who has made this issue the cornerstone of his 2016 election, and it really hasn't let up. So, I mean, it's honestly hard to say what he is going to do, but I do know that there is interest in Congress amongst some Republicans and a supermajority of Democrats who would like to see long-term policy passed. But that, I think, is down the road.
President Trump's approval rating dropped during the last shutdown. A shutdown has negative ramifications for everyday Americans. If lawmakers cannot reach a deal by Friday night, politically, what is at stake here?
Well, I think that those around the president are reminding him, and he pays a lot of attention to his poll numbers as well. And I think that might be an impetus for him to go along with this bill and then just keep, you know, pounding away at the idea that they're building the wall. He's indicated that the wall exists when we know that it doesn't. So, I mean, I think that at this point, it's really hard to say, but at this point, I think that he's not going to have much choice but to go along with it. The congressional leadership on the Republican side does not want to see another shutdown.
Susan, thank you for joining us.
You're very welcome.
Susan Johnson is a professor of political science at UW-Whitewater. She directs the Center for Political Science and Public Policy Research. We've been talking about the tentative deal that will be released later this week to avoid a second partial government shutdown. And when we come back, we'll talk to the author of American Advertising Cookbooks, How Corporations Taught Us to Love Spam, Bananas, and Jell-O. Stay with us. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. We're looking at the backstory on how fish-filled Jell-O molds and Spam casseroles came to be. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The advertising golden age of the 1950s and 60s gave companies like Hormel a way into our kitchens through canned meat recipes. But Spam had a run-up. It was invented by J. Hormel in 1937 and enjoyed worldwide exposure during World War II when it was served to soldiers. What is your memory of Spam? What unusual dishes or meals do you remember eating as a kid? Were casseroles made of gelatin a staple on your dinner table? We're at 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Christina Ward is a Wisconsin native and master food preserver for Milwaukee County. Her new book is called American Advertising Cookbooks, How Corporations Taught Us to Love Spam, Bananas, and Jell-O. Christina, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning on this very snowy Wisconsin day.
Yes, I hope you are staying warm and indoors.
Yes.
In your kitchen.
Thinking about making maybe a nice warm casserole for dinner.
Right. Well, let's not get too far from the casserole idea, because if you're of a certain age, you remember growing up and eating all the processed packaged foods, and it's, all of the casseroles. And as you look back, how did things like ham banana rolls and recipes like this start to dominate in the last century? How, what happened here?
Well, it's a beautiful, interesting convergence of American ingenuity. Post World War I, the rise of printing technologies, cheaper paper, food processing technologies, including canning and preservation, all came together to allow for companies to start developing these prepackaged foods. And when you start introducing a lot of new foods to the marketplace, well, you need advertising to get your message out to people. And so it became almost a competition between these companies to both invent recipes, to use their new products, and to corner the market and get folks to use them.
You write that American cookbooks of the 20th century occupy this special place in our culinary and social history, and that they're a reflection of a small group of corporations that wanted us to be, a certain way. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I think one of the items that really I found really interesting in doing the research is that the notion of conglomerates, of companies that are just, one thing, is relatively, a new concept. So many of these conglomerates were founded in the 20s. So General Foods, for example, would own something like a mayonnaise company, a peanut butter company, and a canned fruit company. And so they charged their marketing departments and their home economists that worked for the marketing departments to develop recipes that used all of those items in the same recipe. And that helped give birth to some of those crazy recipes that we see that use, say, Jell-O and tuna fish. And that, as they put those out into the cookbooks, they became like a real interesting landmark for people cooking, because our nature is that we want to experiment. And so folks would see these cookbooks and start experimenting.
Oh, so we saw Dr. Pepper, put out its cookbook with a recipe for every single part of the meal with Dr. Pepper in it.
Yes, and I think what's interesting, too, is a lot of the alcohol companies did the same thing in the 60s and 70s. That idea was that cooking was both something new. So in the early part of the 20th century, it was really just the introduction of electric stoves, refrigerators, and appliances. And so there were a number of cookbooks that came out to teach people how to use these tools. And then these cookbooks became so popular that other companies used that cookbook as an advertising vehicle to get their product out there. I mean, by the time we hit the late 70s, Marlboro cigarettes had their own branded cookbooks. They didn't use cigarettes as an ingredient, but they knew that the cookbooks were so popular that they, too, got into the cookbook business.
We're talking about mystery meat, Jell-O molds, and the rise of corporate food producers expanding their offerings in the 1900s. Christina Ward is our guide to tuna casseroles, so much more. She's a master food preserver for Milwaukee County, and her new book is called American Advertising Cookbooks. Your food nostalgia is welcome at 800-642-1234. Tell us about the most offbeat cookbooks in your collection. What are they, and what kind of recipes are inside? What food advertisements and commercials still stick with you all these years later? Call in at 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Christina, I just laughed about your history with these types of cookings, preserved foods, and being in the back seat with Pepsi in the baby bottle with your sister wanting more Pepsi. I mean, advertisers were really influencing American families.
They were. 7-Up, actually, the 7-Up brand started as with the advertising, and one of their slogans early on was, "We have the youngest customers in the business." I'm sure lots of folks remember being given like 7-Up or ginger ale when they had an upset stomach. A lot of, especially soda pops, actually had their origination as medicinal tonics. Coca-Cola did, Dr. Pepper did, a lot of the root beers did. And so there was this through line of that advertising till we get to that point of the 70s where everything is so processed, so sugar, there's no medicinal value in, in giving a baby a bottle of Pepsi. But sometimes those cultural memories from the advertising, that advertising really hooks into our brains and really influences some of our decisions.
But to fully understand this advertising story, you take us back in history, back to 1876 even, and the so-called Centennial Exhibition in Philadelphia. What happened there, and how did that event shape what was to come?
I think the 1876 Philadelphia Exhibition, in the scope of kind of very similar to some of the other world fairs that were happening around the country, say, every decade or so, but that one in 1876 was really, I think, important and critical because it was the first time that some of the technologies that influenced our food and marketing decisions were introduced to the American public. Some Heyer's root beer was introduced for the first time. Fleischmann's yeast, something that revolutionized bread baking. Bread baking at home was a laborious process, and some people do it today and enjoy it. But for someone who is baking bread every day, having an instant yeast was a lifesaver, as well as the stoves, new stoves that were powered by gas and not wood. And the new engines that were powering trains, new printing presses, all of these technologies were present for the first time at this one exhibition.
When did home economists come on the scene, and how did they influence what was being cooked at home?
It was an interesting, again, all of these things coming together. We become ourselves, we become Americans in the 20th century. The women's suffragette movement had been, again, starting since the mid-1800s. But by the turn of the 19th century, women were working and gaining more rights. And in one of those areas was recognizing home economics, domestic science, as a legitimate branch of study. As women were working to improve their own communities and their own lot in life, they finally got recognition by the United States government as something that's a legitimate field of study, and it was starting to be incorporated at the universities, especially in the great Midwestern land-grant universities. So a woman who, again, oftentimes denied the opportunity to go to college, could go to university and study the domestic sciences. And that gave rise to a whole generation of women educated in food science, nutrition, and domestic engineering, who then became teachers and spreading out throughout the country, teachers who were working in schools and then, of course, working for corporations, developing nutritional and maybe not so nutritional recipes for their cookbooks.
And so at home, women in the kitchen were aspiring to produce what these home economists were basically telling them to produce.
Yeah, and if you're of a certain age, you may remember taking a home ec class in high school, and that is still born of that tradition. part of that is the assimilation of the great melting pot and the home economics departments at both universities and then disseminated through high schools up until, like, say, the early 80s was a way to teach people the quote-unquote American way of cooking. And, of course, there's some unintended consequences in that, of that it became a little bit judgmental as to where your ethnic cooking was. It was, you know, something might be not healthy or not smelly, not based on any really nutritional facts, but based on, you know, the science of the time, which was, you know, sometimes prejudicial.
And we're going to talk about that and the advertising behind some of those messages. Christina Ward writes in her new book, American Advertising Cookbooks, that by the late 60s and early 70s, advertisers couldn't resist cookbooks. Dr. Pepper had a recipe for every type of meal, including the iconic soda pop chicken. Did you eat it? Join in at 800-642-1234. What unusual dishes or meals do you remember eating as a kid? Were casseroles made of gelatin a staple on your dinner table? What about potlucks? Call in 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Up next, it's news, and we'll continue our conversation about how corporations have used advertising and cookbooks. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're looking at how corporate advertising and throngs of home economists influenced American cuisine during the 20th century. Sue Swanson was the invented spokeswoman for the TV dinner. Betty Crocker was created in 1921 to be that friendly expert giving advice and recipes. In the 1950s, General Mills launched a line of cake mixes under the Betty Crocker brand, and sales of instant cake mixes soared.
No one really can resist a rich, moist cake made with a Betty Crocker cake mix. Mmm, it's got that special homemade goodness, just begging to be eaten. Boy, I'd grab a slice of it, too. It's just as fluffy and moist as the cakes Betty Crocker and her staff make.
Do you remember the allure of prepackaged food? What about TV dinners? And what food advertisements and commercials still stick with you all these years later? We're at 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Christina Ward is a master food preserver for Milwaukee County, and her new book is American Advertising Cookbooks. Christina, where we stopped the conversation there was as we were talking about the impact of stereotypes and overt racism in branding, in advertising. You know, there was Aunt Jemima, Uncle Ben. There was Maxwell House Coffee sponsoring Amos and Andy radio programs. So what did we learn there from seeing these stereotypes and this overt racism?
Unfortunately, we see this racism pop up in our culture, as well as, you know, in the advertising from time to time. But we're definitely getting better as the culture from the 20th century to now the 21st century. What's acceptable then was not acceptable now. But a lot of time, the racism and the caricatures were used to give a connotation of, like, kind of down homeism. A lot of the brands that were using racist advertising, like the cream of wheat and the Aunt Jemima, were not actually rooted in the South, but were Northern companies. And there was a sense of nostalgia that grew up about antebellum Southern culture post-Civil War that was somehow this gentility. And so they adopted, these brands adopted this idea of a lesser servant to give that idea that you might not be able to afford having household domestic help, but you could get the same quality by using a product that was branded that way. And it's a real insidious kind of messaging that gets put out into the culture, and we can always work just to keep our eyes open and make sure that we stamp it out when we see it today.
And does it still linger today? Because we still see these products. We still see Uncle Ben, Aunt Jemima. So is it still lingering today?
I believe it is. And if you look throughout time, the advertisers, the companies, you know, they don't have a sense of the kind of cultural morality that we as human beings do. So they will always respond based on feedback from the people on how the sales are. So if you notice, actually, like they say, the image of Aunt Jemima has changed. She's been given kind of a makeover over the years that, you know, really, if you look at her, the image today versus when it was introduced, it's much less of a caricature based in minstrel show characters versus, you know, just a kind of an African-American housewife. But again, the history still lingers. I think one of the interesting ones is that when people band together to kind of raise a hue and cry against these types of kind of offensive images, the companies respond and they will change.
So Betty Crocker as well was this white woman on a box. Now today, Betty Crocker, the logo is a red spoon. So General Motors, General Mills, there's evolving somewhat.
Yeah, absolutely. They looked at it and realized that for their branding, as they expand, they had much better reaction for their brand with a red spoon versus having the woman, you know, who was just a representational of an upper middle class housewife on the packaging. Again, so the companies always will respond to what the market wants and, you know, based on sales. So they, you know, I'm thinking the Lay's company introduced a very offensive character in 1967, the Frito Bandito, who is to be the mascot of Frito's corn chips. And through organization with the Mexican Anti-Defamation League, they were able to let the Lay's company know that this was a terribly offensive caricature. And the Lay's company, within 3 years, they got rid of that that mascot. And so, again, people can make a difference.
It seems also like corporations got away with peddling some seriously dubious health claims. We had talked about 7-Up being marketed for babies for upset stomachs. Was there any regulation here on what they could claim in their advertising?
What's interesting is that there's always been kind of almost a roller coaster in regulation. So up until, again, that the turn of the 20th century, there really wasn't a lot of regulation. And in 1905, the Clean Food and Drug Act made it federal law that there were essentially national formularies that decided what a food was. So if you grew up in the 80s, you may remember there was kind of a debate about, is ketchup a vegetable? And a lot of that is based on the idea of a formulary, the idea of what is, you know, a food and what does it have to have in it. Now, post-World War I and then the 20s and 30s, the laws were then changed again to allow different types of kind of processed percentages to enter into the foods. If you notice, that's the difference between Velveeta isn't called like a cheese, but a cheese food.
Uh-huh.
And so there's a lot of changes happened through the manufacturers making lobbying changes and, you know, asking the legislators kind of change what the rules and the laws are.
How did various world events of the 20th century, like World War II, how did that have an impact on what kind of foods were being pushed on American households?
I think that one of the what it's difficult for some of us to remember now as we sit in, you know, 2019, is that a couple generations ago, people were actually hungry and starving, especially after World War I. It was just a worldwide crisis of getting food to people. And that's where the relaxation of some of the standards happened. And so you get the meat products, which are high fat and high in salt, and canned. So that's where you see the rise of like canned meats. And those were sent to areas of where folks really needed help, especially in Europe. those products were continually developed and used for rations in World War II. And as people developed a taste for really salty, fatty foods, the manufacturers then brought them back to civilians post-World War II. And that's where we started developing a taste for things that were extra salty, extra sweet, and extra fatty.
We're on a journey through the 20th century food marketing tactics and the recipes born out of food processors. Christina Ward is our guide. She is a master food preserver for Milwaukee County. Her new book is called American Advertising Cookbooks. What are your memories of Spam and Jell-O? Are there jingles or advertisements that stick with you still today? Call in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Christina, let's look at Spam. It's basically everyone's favorite or least favorite canned meat product. Spam gets a lot of bad raps, and despite that, this is a product that's been around for more than 80 years. What is Spam's story, and where is it today?
Spam occupies an interesting place. It's the one we remember most, but every meat packer in the 20th century had a canned meat product, from the Cudahy Packing House in Cudahy, Wisconsin, to Armour Meats. Everybody had a version of a Spam. Spam did very well because of how Hormel marketed it post-World War II. And that's really what kept it alive for people today. They are actually if you look at Spam today, they're introducing some of the new products, reduced sodium, reduced salt, and different versions of Spam, spicy Spam, jalapeno Spam. So they're trying to react to some of the current tastes in the market. I think the challenge that those types of products have is that we're becoming more savvy consumers. And so the story of Spam started as a replacement, as a ration product, and then became like an alternative for a real cheap meat, a cheap protein. But now we have better options today. So I think you'll see less and less Spam consumption.
How did you see Spam pop up in the cookbooks?
The Hormel company and all of the meat packing companies took advantage, again, of all those great cheap technologies and as well as the trend towards cookbooks, and started creating more and more recipes. And so that's where it really started taking off, and they did a really great job introducing new ideas on how to use Spam, where if you think about just like what are you going to do with that little kind of like salty chunk of meat, and so that they started creating these crazy recipes like Spam pizza, Spam and pineapple pizza, and just really over the top, as which was kind of a lot of the companies really became over the top with their recipe development. And those are the ones we tend to remember today, because just because they published the recipe doesn't mean that people liked it or ate it.
The 1950s through the 70s marked a heyday for advertising cookbooks, and author Christina Ward points out that some things haven't changed all that much. Corporations are still producing vast amounts of processed foods. Foods gets the air quote there. And advertising invades every aspect of our life. What do you remember from the foods of your youth and how your family approached cooking? Let's talk about it at 800-642-1234. The new book is American Advertising Cookbooks, How Corporations Taught Us to Love Spam, Bananas, and Jell-O. The conversation continues here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about the evolution of processed foods and how companies and their advertising were marketed through cookbooks during the 20th century. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Author Christina Ward writes that before we arrived at sugared everything, companies focused on convincing housewives that no meal was complete unless dessert was served. Her book is called American Advertising Cookbooks, How Corporations Taught Us to Love Spam, Bananas, and Jell-O. Let's go straight to the phones now with Sharon joining us from Flambeau. Sharon, hi. What about these foods?
I can't believe you're having a program about these two foods because I was just talking about them the other day. I grew up in the South, and we lived in coastal Mississippi when Hurricane Camille hit back in the late 60s, and Spam was the only available meat food, canned food, that we ate pretty much for about 3 weeks. And so I really developed a distaste for Spam. Then I moved to Hawaii later in life, and I could not get over the fascination that Hawaiians have for Spam. It's in everything. They have Spam sushi, which is unbelievable. They call it Spam Mitsubi. Oh, my gosh. And I do not like Spam, but I think it was out of a necessity. It's actually a type of canned meat that was given to the military, and that's how people in Hawaii got used to it. It was cheap. It was left over, and they could buy it, you know, just about anywhere.
Sharon, what's your relationship with Spam today?
I don't eat it. I actually cringe when I walk by it in the grocery store. I just, knowing also what might be in it is also cringeworthy. But people love Spam. They fry it with eggs. Oh, my goodness. I just can't eat it. And, you know, when you do develop a taste for it, people just love it.
Sharon, thank you for telling us your history with Spam. Christina, there's some history there that Sharon started out there in 1969 with that Hurricane Camille and having to rely on it.
And I think, and that's where the food preservation interest for me started, is as the technology grew, the ability to can meat, to can any kind of food where folks could store up and use these things in emergency situations. So the canned preserve processed foods became kind of an important part, both in war situations, where starvation was imminent, and as well as in emergency situations. It's one of the reasons that folks will still go back to when you're looking at, you know, unfortunate emergency situations, canned food drives, because it's something that's relatively shelf-stable and has some nutritional value to it. And, you know, folks, in an emergency, you can eat it and you can get the calories that you need to keep on moving forward.
Let's bring in another call now. Vicki is joining us from Appleton. Hi, Vicki.
Hi. This has been a fascinating program. I'm 75 and feel like I've evolved through much of this. My grandmother was from Helena, Montana, and went to the University of Wisconsin, I think around 1910. For education, and it was home ec. I always wondered why she did home ec, but apparently there weren't a whole lot of options. And then growing up in the 50s, Mom was a war bride, and I don't think knew how to cook at all, and used all that packaged stuff, which a lot of, I mean, Betty Crocker cake mixes certainly made cooking a lot easier. But she also used those Jell-O packaged mixes for pudding fairly often for dessert. And it wasn't until I was an adult that I realized that you didn't have to buy all those different kinds of pudding. All you had to do was mix a little cornstarch with sugar and milk, and you can make any kind of pudding you want.
Vicki, curious how you approach prepackaged and processed foods today with that upbringing you had.
I don't use cake mixes, yeah. I also would, when the kids were growing up, make my own cakes, but I just used regular flour. Referred to them jokingly as thud cakes because they were pretty heavy, but they were, you know, they were fine. You're feeding a family. In the late 60s, there was a cookbook put out, well, not cookbook, a canning book put out that was Putting Food By, that was, for me, wonderful because I had grown up with Mom canning all sorts of fruits,
yeah,
not vegetables. And I once knew someone from the South that went home and that family canned the cow, which was beyond me imagining.
Well, Vicki, let's get Christina here to respond to your story.
Well, first of all, Putting Food By is a seminal food preservation book, originally published in the 70s. It's a great book. And what we see, too, in Vicki's story is almost a kind of a reaction. There was in the 60s, 70s that helped spur like kind of the die-off of some of these advertising cookbooks because people realized that maybe these weren't the healthiest foods at all, and maybe the convenience that the companies were selling wasn't really that convenient when the nutritional trade-off, and people started to embrace some of the old ways, again, to preserve food and make foods from scratch. What's interesting is also then, sounds like, you know, her mom might have been one of the first classes, matriculations in the University of Wisconsin with the new domestic science program. And she's right in that that was one of the only fields of study available to women. So a lot of women who were very interested in sciences had to go to the domestic science, the, you know, home economics program, because they weren't allowed to take those classes in hard science, chemistry, physics, and whatever.
Let's bring in David in Dubuque. David, hi.
Yeah, good morning. I have a Pepsi-Cola entertaining book purportedly, you know, put together by Joan Crawford, who was married to the founder or the current owner of Pepsi in those days in the 50s and 60s. And it's mainly about entertaining, using Pepsi with hors d'oeuvres and at dinner time and giving a really kind of chic atmosphere to the use of Pepsi as a beverage for your good times. Lots of illustrations, and then Joan wrote an introduction, of course. And I don't have it at hand, so I can't remember if there were any actual cooking recipes using Pepsi, so I can't say that. But
well, it sounds like it was a little bit more she, Christina. Pepsi trying to elevate its brand, perhaps?
And Joan Crawford was a board member of PepsiCo when her husband at the time, Alfred Steele, who was the CEO, died. And so she took a real leadership role in how Pepsi was marketed as they were competing with Coke. And that was the genesis of that cookbook and slash entertaining book. And you'll see that, especially that was a 20th century invention, this idea of celebrity endorsement, the idea that, you know, a celebrity could say, well, I use the product too, and therefore, you know, if you want to be like me, you should use the product. And that's what you see in the Pepsi entertaining book. Famously, Kate Smith was a big advocate of Jell-O. And I think I remember as a kid is Rosie Grier, the famous 1970s football player, was an endorser for Carnation milk. And so, you know, celebrities and food products always have been put together in advertising.
Well, this has been so much fun. Thank you so much for joining us, Christina.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's so much fun to hear folks' stories about food.
Christina Ward is a Wisconsin native, and she is a master food preserver for Milwaukee County. Her new book is called American Advertising Cookbooks: How Corporations Taught Us to Love Spam, Bananas, and Jell-O. You hear this conversation on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.